Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Christian Science Monitor Daily program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. This is the Friday, April 17, 2026 issue of the Monitor. All of the articles were published on April 17th. So I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this article. The title is, What Trump's Handling of the Iran War Has Done to Perceptions of U.S. Power, by Howard LaFranchi, a staff writer for the Monitor. Within hours of U.S. President Donald Trump's April the 7th announcement of a two-week ceasefire with Iran, Iranians poured into Tehran's Revolution Square, cheering, honking horns, and waving Iran's tricolored flag. Some burned the stars and stripes amid angry chants. This display of nationalism was undoubtedly not the scene Mr. Trump envisioned when, in late February, he called on Iranians to rise up and join the U.S.-Israeli effort he had just launched to bring the Islamic Republic to its knees, if not, end it all together. Following hard on the president's threats to bomb Iran back to the Stone Age and destroy its civilization, the scene was telling for America's friends and foes alike. It was one more exhibit in a mounting pile of evidence that with this war, something had changed, that the global superpower was no longer the fearsome enforcer and unchallenged leader of an international order that had prevailed since World War II. In the generations since that war, perceptions of America's awesome military and economic power and the diplomatic problem-solving that relied upon it were established that did not depend on its use. It was an era of a confident and largely benevolent superpower, Ronald Reagan's shining city upon a hill. For most of the post-World War II era, the United States largely acted as if it understood that powerful states benefit when they are perceived as mostly honest and reliable, even virtuous, and generally motivated by a desire to make the world better, says Stephen Walt, a professor of international relations at the Harvard Kennedy School. The United States has not been bashful about using its military power in the past, he says, but this war has demonstrated how the superpower that has always tried to cloak its use of power with legitimacy and, as a last resort, has become a disruptive and crude rogue state. The whiplash the world is now experiencing as a result of the Iran war appears certain to continue for weeks, if not months. After the United States and Iran failed to reach any agreement during one day of talks in Pakistan on April the 11th, President Trump ordered U.S. naval forces to impose a blockade on the Strait of Hormuz. Gulliver versus Asymmetric Warfare. No one is questioning America's unrivaled military might or its ability to deploy unequaled capabilities to deliver awe-inspiring tactical results. Acknowledgement is universal that few other powers could have mounted missions like the January snatching of then-Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro from his Caracas compound, or the rescue this month of a downed airman from a mountainside deep inside Iranian territory. But perhaps just as stunning for the world is how Gulliver has been tied down by a Lilliputian, a militarily inferior but clever opponent whose ropes to restrain the behemoth were asymmetric warfare and the seizure of a key global economic choke point, the Strait of Hormuz. even as Iran announced on April 17th that the passage was open to traffic for the remainder of the ceasefire, a U.S. blockade of Iranian ports continued. Equally unsettling for U.S. allies and partners, not to mention instructive to adversaries, is what the war says about the state of U.S. strategic thinking and planning. The Iran war was a stupid idea and a foolish mistake, French President Emmanuel Macron said during a visit to Seoul, South Korea in early April. Comparing the latest U.S. war with past military interventions in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya, he asked whether anyone now considers any of those wars a good idea. The superpower that built its global reach and superiority with a constellation of alliances unequaled in history had launched a war without consulting those allies or providing an initial explanation of the war's objectives. Secretary of State Marco Rubio did offer key allies a report on the war's aims at a March 27th meeting in Paris of foreign ministers from the group of seven countries. But it came a month after the start of hostilities, listing objectives he claimed had been clear from the very first night the president announced the war, Mr. Rubio said. We're going to destroy Iran's navy, destroy their air force, basically destroy their ability to make missiles and drones in their factories. The war would also dramatically reduce the number of missile launchers, he added, so that they cannot hide behind these things to build a nuclear weapon and threaten the world. No longer an anchor of stability, yet the reliable guarantor of the norms and sea lanes of a stable and universally beneficial global economy, had seemingly failed to take into account the far-reaching impact the war could have on that economy. Indeed, it is being felt from the kitchens of Bangladesh and schools and workplaces of Pakistan to the plastics molding plants of Texas and the wheat fields of North Dakota. I really think this war has demonstrated what we will look back on as an inflection point, says Rosemary Kalanick, director of the Middle East Program at Defense Priorities, a Washington think tank that promotes restraint in U.S. foreign policy. Going forward, the world will have to figure out how to deal with a diminished and unpredictable great power that is no longer the reliable anchor of stability it has generally been. President Trump has insisted that the U.S. is, in fact, acting on the world's behalf by finally addressing a menace, Iran's Islamic Republic, that he says has employed terrorism, threatened regional stability by its own actions, and through proxies, and raised the notion of nuclear Armageddon with its uranium enrichment program. Recognition is indeed practically universal that Iran has long been a bad actor that the world would ignore and leave unrestrained at its own peril. And U.S. presidents since Barack Obama have taken steps to set back Iran's advancing nuclear program. Before Mr. Obama secured a 2015 deal with Iran to constrain its program, formerly called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, his administration acted in tandem with Israel to deploy cyber worms to disable Iran's uranium-enriching centrifuges. The cyber attacks carried out in 2009 and 2010 were hailed for slowing Iran's nuclear progress and extending the time for diplomacy to succeed without recourse to war. The war in Iran, notes Dr. Walt, is not the first act of Mr. Trump's second term that suggests the unilateral use of force will take primacy over diplomacy, but it will be the most consequential for global perceptions of the American superpower. There's no doubting anywhere that the United States has an unrivaled capacity to blow things up, he says. But what the war has also revealed is a superpower being led by a combination of impulsiveness and strategic incompetence that portends an unstable and untethered global order going forward. Suez, the fall and rise of powers. To find a similar turning point in history, when a global power revealed its own retrenchment through an ill-conceived conflict of its own making, some historians and analysts of great power politics are looking back to the Suez Canal crisis of October 1956. The crisis pitted World War II victors, Britain and France, against the brash nationalist president of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser. Global colonial power Britain thought it could quickly reverse, through a show of military might, Mr. Nasser's nationalization and then closing of the Suez Canal. Instead, Britain was humiliated by its inability to compel Egypt to open the vital waterway. Mr. Nasser came out of the crisis as an anti-colonial hero, while Britain retreated to second-tier power status behind the United States, which helped devise a diplomatic solution to the crisis. Britain and France concocted a scheme to control the canal, and it completely backfired, says Dr. Kalanick. It was a shoot-yourself-in-the-foot moment that revealed Britain to be weaker than people thought it was, and no longer the global power it had once been. Fast-forwarding to the Iran war, she says, I think it's legitimate to consider if this is a similar moment that demonstrates to the world the weaknesses and questionable judgment of a great power. Others say that, at least to some degree, both allies and adversaries have already decided that the U.S. is no longer going to be the predictable and consultative superpower they knew before. The rest of the world has already considered the unsteadiness of American statecraft and the prolonged period of political dysfunction and fierce political polarization in the United States, says Charles Kupchan, Director of European Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. The Iran war simply confirms to our allies, especially, that Uncle Sam is not going to be there for you. Even before the war, world leaders were recognizing the implications of this shift in America's approach to the use of its power. Perhaps the starkest example came from Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney in a speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, in January. The rules-based world order enabled by American hegemony, he declared, was experiencing a rupture, not a transition, in which great powers were henceforth using economic integration, tariffs, the international financial infrastructure, and global supply chains as weapons. Mr. Carney called on middle powers to band together to enhance their global heft, because if we're not at the table, we're on the menu. He received a standing ovation, a rare show of solidarity at a Davos conference. Conventional versus cheaper military power. When Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth deemed Operation Epic Fury an overwhelming victory at an April the 8th Pentagon news conference and said of Iran, "We own their skies," some military analysts winced. By focusing almost exclusively on the military achievements wrought by conventional air power, some now wonder, is the U.S. at risk of missing one of the key lessons coming out of this war? Is the U.S. slow to grasp the emergence of a new kind of warfare that challenges the supremacy of the heavy and expensive hardware the U.S. relies on? The Iran war underscores how some of the elements of modern military power have changed very dramatically, revealing a landscape where new technologies, just think of drones here, are favoring the defensive and weaker power in a major way, says Michael Desch, director of the O'Brien Notre Dame International Security Center. We have belatedly come to that realization, he adds, and that's going to have huge implications in the Persian Gulf, and if ever there's a shooting war around Taiwan. Certainly elements of conventional modern warfare, such as air power, remain effective in the tactical sense, Dr. Desch says, adding that failing to learn the lessons of those elements' limits won't serve the U.S. well. The last time we were going to bomb an enemy, back to the Stone Ages, it was North Vietnam, he says. What I would have hoped we learned since then is that while air power does a lot of damage, at some point you're just making rubble bounce without necessarily achieving your objectives. With its use of drones and ballistic missiles, Iran was able to keep itself in the game against a much more formidable opponent, wreaking havoc in the region even as it was being pummeled hard at home. Not just U.S. adversaries are taking lessons from what the Iran war says about shifts in hard power. We know that in military terms, there is no equal to the United States, says Anna Maria Diner, head of the International Security Program at the Polish Institute of International Affairs in Warsaw. But we also hope that in our partnership with the U.S., we can learn the lessons of these new technologies that we have seen Ukraine deploying effectively against Russia, and now Iran in this war. Such a common purpose would be good for the U.S. and Europe, Ms. Diner noted, noting that while the transatlantic marriage is passing through difficult times, we know we are stronger together. That strength of common purpose was on display when the European powers joined the Obama administration in pressuring Iran to reach the international accord limiting its nuclear program. The JCPOA was hammered out over 2 years of intense negotiations, largely between the U.S. and Iran, but with the diplomatic backing of Europe, Russia, and China. That buy-in gave the agreement international legitimacy and sent Iran a critical message of global support for the deal. In 2018, during his first term, President Trump withdrew from the JCPOA, calling it a horrible, one-sided deal. But many nuclear experts counter that. Though the deal was not perfect, it did subject Iran's nuclear program to international oversight, whereas scuttling it freed Iran to pursue its nuclear ambitions. Those experts also note that the Trump administration floated proposals in recent discussions with the Iranians before the war and since the ceasefire that would result in a deal resembling the JCPOA. One key difference, however, is that the two parties reportedly discussed a suspension of Iran's nuclear activities for some determined period of time, a halt in the program the JCPOA never achieved. The talks, whether ultimately successful or not, have spawned a debate pitting those who say the negotiations underscored diplomacy's superiority over war as an instrument of statecraft against those who say the war was the necessary first step to compel Iran to return to the negotiating table. Beyond the nuclear issue, the Polish Institute's Ms. Diner notes that the difficult times roiling the transatlantic partnership have been exacerbated for some European partners by the violent rhetoric employed by the Trump administration. That includes Mr. Trump's threat to destroy Iran's civilization, and Secretary Hegseth's pledge last year to deploy maximum lethality, not tepid legality, to violent effect, not politically correct. But Ms. Diner says she has a different take on the rhetoric from that of her offended European colleagues. Sometimes this kind of rhetoric is needed because it's the only language some adversaries understand, she says. Certainly we in Poland know that Russia only understands the language of power. Trump's new posture versus Xi. When President Trump visits Xi Jinping in mid-May, he'll sit down with a Chinese leader who kept a close eye on the U.S. war in Iran, analysts say, and who apparently liked much of what he saw. Trump is going to arrive in Beijing weakened by a war that did not go as he planned, weakened by the unpopularity of the war with the American public, and that means Xi will have the upper hand, says Dr. Cup Chan of the Council on Foreign Relations. China, like America's other adversaries, can't help but be satisfied with where the war leaves the U.S., says the Kennedy School's Dr. Walt. We've spent a lot of money. We've drawn down our armaments stockpiles, and we weakened our military partners, including our Asian allies, he says. The war has had downsides for China as well, which might explain why President Xi nudged Iran to accept Pakistan's invitation to peace talks. President Trump publicly acknowledged Mr. Xi's role in getting Tehran to the table. But more than anything, Beijing has happily sat back and watched the U.S. get bogged down by what it sees as another misguided use of its hard power, Dr. Walt says. Citing a line often attributed to Napoleon, he adds that Mr. Xi must have the same observation. Never interrupt your enemy when he's making a mistake. Napoleon's quote has its limits. One good reason the world might have had wanted to interrupt the U.S. war in Iran would have been to at least limit the damage of a global economic crisis spawned by the war. But for some political leaders and analysts, the world's even more troubling takeaway from the war might be the realization that for the foreseeable future, it must learn to grapple with a diminished but unpredictable and even aggressive superpower. Citing the U.S. president's threat to end a civilization, British Liberal Democrats leader Ed Davey said in a House of Commons speech on April 14th that, quote, "These words are a stark reminder of how reckless, immoral, and completely outside the bounds of international law this president is," end quote. He went on to declare Mr. Trump no friend of the UK and no leader of the free world. Notre Dame's Dr. Desch says the world's discomfort with increasingly partisan and unpredictable American global leadership precedes President Trump, but has reached a new level under him. The U.S. has been something of a rogue elephant for some time, but there's no question We've become more rogue late recently, says Dr. Desch. If you're a smaller animal in the forest, it can't be reassuring to know you'll be living with this elephant. And that completes the article. The title of the article was What Trump's Handling of the Iran War Has Done to Perceptions of U.S. Power, by Monitor staff writer Howard LaFranchi. I'm going to take a minute out of the broadcast to remind those of you who may have tuned in late, you're listening to the Christian Science Monitor Daily program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is the Friday, April 17th, 2026 issue. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. Continuing on with this article, Why the Surveillance Powers in FISA Royal Congress Across Party Lines, by contributor Ross Herbert. With a statutory deadline fast approaching, Congress is immersed in what has become one of the most enduring and internally divisive fights. Whether and how to preserve government foreign surveillance powers while protecting the civil liberties of Americans whose communications get swept up in the intelligence gathering. The U.S. House of Representatives voted early Friday to approve a 10-day stopgap extension to Section 702 of the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, which has been set to expire April 20th. That came after a 5-year extension, with new provisions to address critics' concerns, failed on the House floor. Now the Senate must also pass a short-term extension to buy Congress more time on the issue. The votes, defying a simple party-line split, reflect a debate that has simmered for decades. The renewal is opposed by a mix of liberals and privacy-minded conservatives. The issue is highlighting larger tensions over balancing national security with personal liberty, tensions that are only growing amid political turmoil at home and abroad, and the rise of technologies like artificial intelligence. President Donald Trump was once a bitter critic of FISA, which he said allowed the government to spy on his 2016 campaign. But in recent weeks, he has urged lawmakers to reauthorize Section 702, crediting it for military successes in Venezuela and Iran. What is FISA Section 702 all about? The provision, added to the law in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, regulates who has access, and for what purposes, to a database of communications gathered by U.S. intelligence agencies on foreign targets. When Americans communicate with such targets, their information gets swept into Section 202 databases that are accessible by the FBI. Critics charge that FBI queries of the database violate the Constitution's Fourth Amendment, which prohibits searches unless there's a judicial warrant that specifically lists what is to be searched and attests that there is probable cause to suspect a crime. They urge a legal change to require warrants to access any 702 data on Americans. Supporters of the existing system say that an effective intelligence sharing system could have prevented the September 11, 2001 attacks or the 2009 Fort Hood attack. In both cases, the U.S. held crucial intelligence information but failed to get it into the right hands and act on it. By a 200-220 vote, the House rejected a compromise extension bill imposing warrant requirements. The process of obtaining a warrant would prevent investigators from revealing crucial information, argues Adam Klein, a law professor and director of the Robert Strauss Center for International Security and Law at the University of Texas. He was deeply involved in FISA and 702 issues as a former chairman of the U.S. Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. Imagine that today an FBI agent is checking out a tip that a person inside the United States is expressing support for ISIS or the Islamic State, asking questions about martyrdom and posting online about buying weapons. That's enough to talk to community members about the person and check FBI databases. But you can't get a warrant at that stage, Mr. Klein says. If the government had already collected messages between that person and an ISIS terrorist overseas, that's extremely alarming. We want the agent to know that right away. But requiring a warrant at that stage, he says, would mean that the agent couldn't check those records, records the government already has. You'd never know the information was there. The gains from surveillance. Stuart Baker, former general counsel for the National Security Agency, testified to the Senate on January 28th that Section 702 information helped identify the Chinese origins of imported fentanyl precursor chemicals, respond to ransomware attacks on U.S. companies, and disrupt foreign government kidnappings, assassinations, and espionage on U.S. soil. He noted that in 2001, intelligence agencies knew that an al-Qaeda house in Yemen was in communication with people in the U.S. The 702 capability did not exist then, but if it had, and the Saudi hijackers behind the September 11th attacks had been checked, the tragedies of that day might have been averted. If we had had a system where you could quickly identify people in the United States having conversations with terrorists, we almost certainly would have caught those guys. They were in the U.S. for weeks or months before the attacks, Mr. Baker said. Similar failures occurred in the case of Nidal Hassan, the soldier who killed 13 people at Fort Hood in 2009, after exchanging 20 emails with ISIS propagandist Anwar al-Awlaki. If soldiers and people with security clearances were routinely checked against the 702 data, such communications would be revealed, and a tragedy might be averted. Cities, however, say such practices would cross a line into improper invasion of privacy. More broadly, they worry about the implications of an ever-growing surveillance state at a time when democracy seems to be under strain. The government is collecting vast quantities of communications from Americans. They don't even know how much. And then it is searching through these communications without first obtaining a warrant, which fundamentally violates the Fourth Amendment, which guards against unreasonable searches, says Kia Hamadanchi, Senior Policy Counsel on National Security Issues for the American Civil Liberties Union. Many opponents of the present FISA law also want reforms to include a ban on the government buying personal information from data brokers that would otherwise require a warrant. After Edward Snowden's revelation that government was vacuuming up phone records on all Americans in bulk, Congress outlawed the practice with the 2015 USA Freedom Act. The government is now buying everyone's data in bulk from commercial data brokers. This is not part of FISA, but there is no law governing data brokers. If there ever was a time to fix this loophole, Now is the time to do it, says Jake LaPeroque, Deputy Director of the Security and Surveillance Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology. Catching criminals or risking rights? Cybercrime is one area where 702 data can identify when scammers are trying to victimize innocent Americans. Tracing communications from criminals to their targets could help prevent crime, but there is usually no probable cause. Mr. Hamadanchi argues that the call for warrants does not prevent such efforts, because there are exceptions built into the alternative bills. Congress has already taken some steps to rein in abuses of 702 data. In 2024, it passed the Reforming Intelligence and Securing America Act. A vote at the time to include a warrant requirement failed in a tied House vote. Instead, Congress settled on 56 reforms, including quarterly reports to Congress, required annual FISA court-approved approval of procedures, audits to ensure rules are followed, penalties for abuses, and congressional access to FISA courts. And before agents can query the 702 data, they must log their reasons for the inquiry and obtain supervisor approval. This week, Ohio Representative Jim Jordan, the Republican chair of the House Judiciary Committee, told the House Rules Committee that he changed his views on FISA warrants because of the success of the 2024 reforms. Last year, the FBI reported conducting just 9,089 queries on U.S. persons. Of those, 127 did not comply with the rules. In light of the progress that has been made and the threats that we face, we think a temporary short-term extension makes sense now, he said. But divisions over extending Section 702 cross party and ideological lines. Opponents in the Senate include Democrats like Oregon Senator Ron Wyden and Illinois Senator Dick Durbin, as well as Republicans like Senators Rand Paul of Kentucky, Mike Lee of Utah, and Josh Hawley of Missouri. In the House, those opposed range from Democratic Representatives Pramila Jayapal of Washington, Jerry Nadler of New York, and Ro Khanna of California, to Republicans like Representative Andy Biggs of Arizona, Lauren Boebert of Colorado, and Anna Paulina Luna of Florida. Experts say President Trump's lobbying for an extension likely increased some Democrats' suspicion of the provision. Trump's general reputation among Democrats is such that it undercuts the case for an easy renewal of 702, says Liza Goitin, Senior Director of the Brennan Center for Justice, who focuses on FISA issues. She says Mr. Trump removed several members of the U.S. Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board that oversees FISA, which means the board no longer can monitor 702 compliance because it lacks a quorum. A classified court decision cast further doubt on the effectiveness of the 2024 reforms. Last year, the Department of Justice brought information to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that FBI agents had been using a software filtering tool that effectively allowed queries without having to log the inquiry purpose or obtain approval. Ms. Goitin argues that this end-run system was used for an unknown number of inquiries and mitigates the appearance of progress cited by Representative Jordan and others. The court order remains classified, but the White House sent unclassified talking points to Congress that acknowledged that the issue must be appealed or the filtering tool removed. A Bremen Center report on the court case noted the actual number of U.S. person queries for 2024 remains unknown and likely unknowable. And because no audits of these queries were conducted, the reported increase in compliance cannot be taken at face value. We simply do not know the extent or nature of any abuses that might have occurred during this period. And that completes the article. The title was Why the Surveillance Powers in FISA Royal Congress Across Party Lines by contributor Ross Herbert. This article's title is A Global Lens on Kitchen Table Bills by staff writer Stephanie Haynes. During an editorial meeting earlier this year, international editor Sarah Miller Lilana and I started talking about a topic that seemed to be everywhere: affordability. In the United States, voters regularly cite cost of living as their top concern, and political analysts say it will likely be a central topic in this year's midterm elections. But affordability isn't just an American issue, Sarah pointed out. People around the world, from Nigeria to the Netherlands, had been protesting cost of living stressors for months. And at the time, massive protests around affordability in Iran were prompting a brutal government crackdown. At the Monitor, one of our goals is to bring a global lens to topics like this one. This sort of perspective can help readers see in a more complete way the situations they face in their own homes, towns, and countries. And when stories shine light on that picture more broadly, it can open hearts to neighbors, both near and far, illuminate something bigger than oneself, and often point towards solutions. So over the past few months, Sarah, National Editor Mark Trumbull, and I have been working with Monitor reporters to come up with a group of stories that could bring this more extensive perspective to the issue of affordability. Our first story is this week. We start in India, where Akash Hassan and Lindsay McGinnis wrote about the squeezing of the middle class in a country where this demographic is expanding rapidly. The story they tell, I believe, will resonate for anyone sifting through bills at their kitchen table. As one expert they interviewed explains, the middle class is that demographic with enough money to have choices about what to do with it, even when those choices feel tough. The fact that Lindsay and Akash's main characters live in New Delhi rather than in New York shows not only the expanse of this topic, but also the connections people share across ethnicity and nationality. Over the next few weeks, we will share stories about housing, food, transportation, and energy, often cited as key affordability markers, from multiple continents and multiple perspectives. We hope you find these pieces illuminating as well as connecting. This next article comes to us from the Home Forum section of the Monitor. Its title is Hope in the Soil and Stones by Murr Brewster, a contributor. Down the street a ways, there is a parking strip by a soccer field, a half block long and about 2 feet wide, a wedge of life bounded by concrete. It's meticulously planted in things monarch butterflies like. You could be forgiven for not recognizing the theme if it were not for the numerous educational signs. the smooth rocks carefully painted with genus and species names, the poster about the plight of monarch butterflies and what can be done for them, and the crowning touch, a mounted box like a little free library hung with packets of milkweed seeds instead of books. This is the skinny rectangular work of someone who cares. I certainly appreciated the effort. I figured it was mainly educational. There's a grade school right there, and I visualized a sweet teacher trying to get her students involved. Also, I understood the fundamentals. Monarch butterflies, which are in some trouble these days, like other species, are very specific about where they like to lay their eggs. On milkweed, pretty much to exclusion. But we've lost vast acreages of milkweed to profitable crops, such as corn and soybeans, and the monarchs appear on the verge of crashing. The idea of planting milkweed in parking strips and alleyways and front yards and tucked here and there in our gardens is meant to address this devastation in the heartland and elsewhere. Stretches of milkweed in the Midwest might be easier for an army of monarchs to find, but the monarchs will find it where it exists. Milkweed is their field of dreams, and here someone clearly is building it. Will they come? If I ever doubted that, I did no longer after I planted my first asparagus bed. 40 years ago, it might have been the only stand of asparagus for miles around. Still, within weeks of the emergence of the first spears, a fraternity of asparagus beetles was partying away on the crop. Somehow the chemical signature of our 4-inch-high asparagus spears was telegraphed to the greater asparagus beetle community, whose entire local population came by for spring break. Asparagus beetles are asparagus savants. Insects in general are savants, and that includes the monarchs. Still, I had my doubts about this little patch of milkweed next to the soccer field. Our valley is not a major monarch flyway. The likelihood of some gorgeous little orange flapper finding its way to a milkweed plant here, no matter the sincerity of the gardener, seemed low. Then one day I met the gardener. I caught Ida in the act of replenishing the little free seed library. As it turns out, she had indeed taught art, and her children had attended that school. She'd gotten permission to plant that strip with native plants years ago, but only more recently discovered there had been some success attracting the odd monarch to local patches. And that tilted the whole little landscape toward the butterflies. But if, as one of the painted stones laments, there's been a 99% reduction in monarchs in the past 30 years, it would be pretty easy to assume there's not much one person can do about it. It's pretty easy to mourn and move on. Unless you're Ida. This one person hand-harvested 17 pounds of milkweed seeds last year from a farm down south. She founded a second butterfly oasis on city property across town and tends both patches. She gives talks to schools and interested groups, fosters caterpillars, and paints butterflies on stones to give away or sell. It's an actual seed fund. She purchases nectar flower seed in bulk, and almost every day she rises well before dawn to fill and label tiny seed packets. This is a full-time job. Clearly the woman is not normal. 3 hours a day just on seed packets to replenish 2 little libraries? I can barely keep up, she says. Word's getting around, and so are those seeds. In the process of creating habitat, she is fostering a community of people who care. Maybe there's not much we can do. Maybe we can always do something. I can't help but smile when I see Ida's rollicking street-side ribbon of milkweed, scabiosis, cone flowers, blazing stars, and more. This is art. This is a shrine. This is hope in the soil and stones. It's a lot of work for a volunteer, but Ida is paid in butterflies. Not many, not yet, but some, and more on the way. Around here, that's one fine currency. And that completes the article, Hope in the Soil and Stones, by Murr Brewster, a contributor. The last article today reflects the Monitor's view, written by the Monitor's editorial board. Their title, How Women's Digital Lives Change China. Chinese women not only excel over men in the use of artificial intelligence, but also bring qualities of online engagement that are a model for trusted, empathetic activism in a controlled society. A recent surprise in China was a survey that found professional women have adapted faster to using artificial intelligence than men. They also show less fear of AI. Yet it was the explanation for this AI gender gap that offered a keyhole into how Chinese women are changing themselves and society from inside the narrow lanes imposed upon them by the ruling party. One insight on the survey came from Po Yan Ko, president of FedEx China. She said in the era of AI, the common female traits of flexibility, resilience, empathy, long-term vision, and bridge-building allow women to serve as indispensable interpreters who connect technology with humanity. Technology can be replicated. Empathy cannot, she said. In the age of intelligence, trust is the scarcest resource. Technology might determine how fast society moves, but humanity determines how far we go. Women in China are still locked out of the country's highest positions of power. Yet in the digital universe, they are defining a different future. Humor, coded language, and private networks became safer ways to share experiences and support one another. Lina Ma, a New York-based researcher who specializes on the topic, wrote in The Diplomat. Across platforms such as RedNote, Douyin, and Bilibili, women exchange stories and practical advice about everyday struggles, she wrote. Some posts circulate concrete information, but others help women reinterpret their experiences separate from societal expectations or official controls over public life. This style of informal connection might foreshadow the future of digital activism everywhere. The Chinese example shows that repression does not eliminate political consciousness. Instead, movements adapt, Ms. Ma wrote. One woman who has risen in China's limited national politics is Zhang Shengnan, who started her career as an online writer. She achieved some reforms in the country's largely rubber-stamped parliament. yet her widest influence has been as a trusted, emphatic voice on the internet. Many people support saying that I'm a precious female voice, Ms. Jiang told Shanghai magazine Sixth Tone in 2023. But in fact, I'm just an ordinary female voice. Everyone knows that things are precious because they are scarce. My greatest hope is that I will become less precious as soon as possible. And that completes the Monitor's View today. The title was How Women's Digital Lives Change China by the Monitor's editorial board. And that also completes the broadcast for today. We have run out of time. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor Daily program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. It's the Friday, April 17th, 2026 edition of the Monitor. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader today. I hope you enjoyed the program. I hope you also found it most informative. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona on a 24/7 basis. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.